I don't know if psychedelics can help save the world. I don't know if they can save the world. They're not going to hurt. You know, they're one of many tools that we need to try to save the world.
They can help us not destroy the world and then help us save the world for what needs
number one done. And number two, exactly.
Yeah,
I don't think exactly. It's too late.
Welcome, Dennis. For people who don't know, Dennis McKenna has conducted interdisciplinary research on the ethnopharmacology of Amazonian traditional medicines for over 40 years. He is a founding member, board member of the Hefner Research Institute, taught ethnopharmacology at the University of Minnesota for 17 years, and in 2019, he founded the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy, which is a U.S.-based nonprofit. So that doesn't go very far in covering your contributions to the field of plant medicine beyond, but from a fellow nonprofit, MAPS Canada, to your nonprofit, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Luke, you pronounce your name Luke or Luke?
Just Luke, yeah.
Luke, okay. Well, thank you, Luke, very much for inviting me. I appreciate your introduction, which was mercifully short. Only one slight correction. It's the Hefter Research Institute, not the Hefter. They were into something else, but Hefter is H-E-F-F-T-E-R, hefter.org. And Hefter, in some ways I regard it as the little brother of MAPS in a certain way. I mean, MAPS is very much out there in the public sphere, and Hefter is not as public. We don't have the public relations, chops that MAPS has. On the other hand, Hefter's been very effective over the years getting funding for different types of investigations of psychedelics, particularly with psilocybin. So, and psilocybin seems to be the one that the community, everybody's excited about psilocybin. These others as well, but psilocybin in some ways has taken the center stage. So I'm moderately proud that Hefter's been very sort of instrumental in getting funding for psilocybin investigation. Roland Griffiths is on our board, has been for 5 years or so. So need I say more?
Right, exactly. And I believe on the website, it was saying that something like 60% of all papers studying psilocybin in the last decades or whatever was involved with the Hefter Institute.
Yes, something like that. Not a bad track record for an organization nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah.
We're only the elite, only a few. But that's true. I don't think when we started the Hefter Research Institute back in 93 or 92, I guess it was, I don't think any of us imagined we'd be in this place now, and they were marginalized then, and we aspired to, help bring them into mainstream science, basically, and that's exactly what happened. And so Hefter's contributed to that, as well as a lot of other people. Of course, MAPS also has been a leader in this area. So, it's a different world now, but it's 40 years later.
Yeah.
So, yes, 30 years later, I guess.
Yeah.
So what is new?
Yeah, there's a lot that's new. And I guess on that note, sort of the reemergence of psychedelics into popular culture and use and research, and now suburban soccer moms are talking about it with their friends. What right. has you hopeful, and what has you maybe cautious about this reemergence?
Well, I'm hopeful. I'm pleased and hope it's very hopeful that these medicines are finally getting recognized in the mainstream and in our culture. They've been around. There's nothing new about psychedelics. They've been used by indigenous cultures for thousands of years. But the mainstream, I guess, of global culture, they've always been either, marginalized and prohibited and condemned, or they've been regarded as a kind of a, not a respectable thing, a thing that rebels and troublemakers and so on are into, And to a certain extent, that's been true because these agents are agents of change. They change minds. They change reference frames. They change our understanding of our relationship with nature, with other people, with our species and the planet. This is a big impact that psychedelics have, as well as being therapeutically. We're beginning now to see that psychedelics are a class of compounds that kind of put a lot of these conventional psychopharmaceuticals like SSRIs in the shade. I mean, SSRIs and psychopharmaceuticals like that may have a place, but they are basically band-aids, They're medications that people can take in order to cope. Psychedelics are medications that people can take that may actually heal their issues, their mental health issues, can resolve the kinds of things that might lead people to go on antidepressants and so on. Psychedelics are tools that let people get to the bottom of what's bothering them and resolve their issues. That said, you don't have to be mentally disabled you don't have to have a diagnosed mental disease to benefit from psychedelics. Bob Jesse was fond of discussing that they can be used for the betterment of the well. And I think that's true. We can all benefit from psychedelics if they're used properly, cautiously, with respect. They're learning tools, basically, and they're teachers. This is a perspective that indigenous societies have always had. Now we're beginning to recognize that what they mean by that. We're assimilating that. And so it's very encouraging to see that these things have gone from being stigmatized, perhaps to being praised, maybe too much. You know how the venture capitalist segment and it finds the next big thing and it touts it, it pumps it and
hypes it up.
Yeah, and sometimes sometimes it's a bit exaggerated, but it's just a matter of really understanding, I think, the promise of what these compounds have. And also the risks, and they are not without risks, but properly employed, they can be very safe and very effective. The risks that come from psychedelics, by and large, have nothing to do with pharmacology. Pharmacologically, as medicines, they're extremely safe, as long as a few common sense guidelines are observed. The risk come in lack of preparation and failure to provide optimal set and setting, which is something we've known ever since the era of Leary and Alpert and the Harvard researchers. And setting is important. You have to create a special situation to have these experiences, to let them unfold. But that's, in the contemporary world, that's going to impact how therapy is done. If psychedelics are incorporated into mainstream medicine, that's going to change a lot in terms of how therapy is conducted. And that's going to have ripple effects in terms of How do you pay for that? Who gets access to it? What does it cost? How do you, you know, it potentially it could upend the current models for mental health care, and it's going to affect economically. So some of the issues also that concern me is, you know, how do you ensure that people do have access to these medicines who really need it, but they may not be able to afford it, you know? So that's an issue. You know, I really don't want to see them become the plaything of the elite, you know, people that can go to a retreat or something, pay $30,000 and have psychedelic therapy, where other people, it's just inaccessible. So we have to find a way that's more egalitarian, that somehow affords access to the people that really need it. And at the same time, we also have to respect the indigenous people that have been the stewards of this knowledge for so long. And you are usually the first ones that are pushed aside when some new big thing comes along. It's like, thank you very much. We'll take these plants, these foods, these medicines, whatever it is that we've been stealing from indigenous groups for, you know, 10,000 years, or more like maybe 500 years, more likely with the Columbian Exchange in the New World. Yeah. But now I think there is a growing recognition that we owe a tremendous debt to the indigenous cultures that have, you know, been the stewards of the knowledge and the genetics and the habitats where they grow. We need to find a way to ensure that they're at the table, you know, they have a stake, and they have a big stake. So this is where venture capitalism needs to acknowledge this debt and try to equitably give something back, you know. And this is happening, you know. Some, I mean, it's not everybody, but I think there's a consensus that this is necessary, and people are trying to, you know, find ways to do this. So that's encouraging.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I know through the McKenna Academy in the past, you've hosted retreats down in Peru, and a big conversation in, especially in the realm of ayahuasca tourism, is in reciprocity and how to do so ethically and not disrupt the economies down there, but still have that knowledge exchange. A friend of mine is in touch with an Amazonian indigenous group and old tribe, and she's looking to actually fly them out to Vancouver instead of flying people down there. And started doing the reverse travel.
Hey, we hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. Now, if you want to support and become part of the psychedelic movement, feel free to donate to MAPS Canada at the link in the description below. Thank you for helping our mission to support equitable access to legal and regulated psychedelic medicines for all Canadians.
This reflects what I've been saying for a while now. Bring the medicine to the people. Don't bring the people to the medicine. You know, and yes, it's true, when the, you know, before the Academy was formed and even after, you know, I was one of those organizing ayahuasca retreats. And it's not something that I'm ashamed of. I mean, I've seen many people benefit from this, but it's something that on further reflection, I've thought maybe this is not the way to do it, you know, or I mean, it's tricky, you know, because of the economic impact that ayahuasca tourism can have on these communities, the strain that it puts on the resources like Banisteriopsis and Chacruna. These are, you know, they're over-harvested, they're over-exploited. So we need to find a way to foster mutual benefit. And I think for the communities to be given a major role in terms of producing these medicines and sharing those with the developed world, if you want to put it that way, not only the medicines, but also their traditional expertise. So the idea of bringing medicines to Vancouver along with traditional healers is exactly the right approach. You know, that's what we have to find ways to do it. Now we have to now explore ways to do that legally, you know, so that these practitioners, you probably know about ICERS, and, you know, ICERS has an ayahuasca defense fund to come to the aid of practitioners that come to North America or Europe and so on, and they get popped, you know, they get busted for having controlled substances. Most of these cases are ridiculous, but, you know, they can create problems. So
yeah,
it's fine for ICERS to say that, you know, they'll bring lawyers and they'll bring legal help for this, but we need to develop frameworks. We need to work with governments, regulatory agencies, and so on, to find a way that these medicines can be brought into the country, US, Canada, or Europe, and used in these traditional contexts that, you know, the semi-traditional context. They may combine psychotherapy with traditional shamanism, but it's not irresponsible use, you know. It's well-regulated use that's helping a lot of people. And there's a path forward to that. You just have to initiate conversations with the appropriate people and you know, try for a consensus on how to go forward. And, of course, MAPS has been the, you know, you're the poster child. In some ways, MAPS is the poster child for how to do this on the regulatory front, having worked with MDMA for so long, and we've seen the progress that's been made. The difference with MDMA and a lot of these others is it's not a natural product, and there's, you know, it doesn't have a thousand-year-old tradition of indigenous use. So a lot of those issues don't come up with MDMA. But people should, I think, have access to natural psychedelics. And in such a way that they are assured of a place and they are assured of not being driven into extinction, you know, and minimize the adverse effects on these cultures, and if possible, maximize the benefits, you know, which can happen from these reciprocal exchanges. So there's a lot to work out on the regulatory level. And those are the concerns I have. But in general, I think the movement is positive, and I'm happy to see it.
For sure, yeah. And I know recently the ICERS, their legal team had success with freeing that, I forget who what his role was specifically, but someone was transporting ayahuasca through Mexico and they got arrested for transporting narcotics harmful for the public health or something. And there's that victory right there recently.
Right. Jose Campos.
That's right.
Yeah, I know him well, and he's a great guy. He's a very good ayahuascaro. This is not the first time he's been nailed. You know, he spent time in France. France is the last place that you want to try to import ayahuasca. It's very unfriendly to this kind of thing. And interestingly, it's not about drugs. With them, it's about cults. And, you know, various people associated with Santo Daime and mostly Santo Daime have gotten into trouble in France because they're identified as a cult and France is not friendly. You know, they have prohibitions against cults. That seems to be a little draconian. I mean, how do you define a cult? I mean, you know, the Catholic Church is a cult. It just happens to be, you know, have several billion members, but it's still a cult.
Yeah.
And I think France is going to make that illegal, although perhaps they should.
Yeah. Christianity was originally the cult of Nicaea, I believe. So, you know, what is a cult?
what is a cult? It's whatever they define it to be. Just an excuse, basically. All this comes down to, you know, effectively, it comes down to the war on consciousness, you know, the war on unconventional ideas, which are inherently dangerous. I mean, my brother always said psychedelics are dangerous because they make you have funny ideas, not because the drugs are dangerous. They make you have forbidden thoughts, you know, they're not compatible with the powers that be. This is why, you know, in the 60s, when they put it into all of this, the reaction was over the top, you know, in a sense. They didn't just prohibit LSD, which was what was causing most of the troubles perceived by some in society. But, you know, so they prohibited LSD, but they prohibited virtually everything else, you know, and shut research down for 20 years, you know, all without knowing really anything about these substances. It's another good example of why, you know, politicians should be fenced off, in my opinion, from making decisions that affect medicine and scientific progress, you know, right, because they don't know anything about it, but they're happy to interfere, as recent, you know, court decisions and this kind of thing illustrate all too well.
Well, hopefully, I mean,
ignorance of politicians cannot be overstated.
Yeah, we do have some friends in politics, and so we happily embrace those who embrace research. So, right.
They're not all idiots. That's true.
Yeah. I've had the opportunity to drink ayahuasca with the Santo Daime up here in Canada a few times, and the real challenge of hosting that is the transport of the medicine, right? They need to, it's a gray area, right? And that seems to be the big challenge with bringing sort of the medicine, the tradition, the knowledge up to the West.
Right, right. How do they do that in Canada?
That's a good question. I've heard something, so I shouldn't
speak
to it.
There's no agreement, for example, with Health Canada that they can bring these things in, or like in the States, you know, the UDV and Santo Daime are protected under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, so they can bring the medicines in. But an individual practitioner, a guy like Jose Campos, who's a freelancer, he's not associated with any institution, he would be at risk at this point. I would not advise him to bring any medicine into the States, you know, until some of this stuff has worked out. And Canada's always been more reasonable about its approach to drug regulation anyway, so they'll probably be the first ones to work out a framework that can make this work. It's already happening, you know. Unfortunately, not so much with ayahuasca, but with mushrooms, they seem ready to open it up to some kind of more reasonable regulatory framework and allow people to use mushrooms. And so that's all going forward, and that's good. You know, that's all good.
Yeah, and we can now enjoy the decriminalization of certain substances, including certain psychedelics, although not psilocybin is specifically listed. But we can enjoy that in Vancouver. So some progress is being made. Yeah. Not without the efforts of all of the nonprofits in the space and everything. And so I'd like to ask you about the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy. And first off, noting that I forget the specific word, but Newton's landmark physics paper was called the Philosophiae Naturale or something like that in Latin. Natural philosophy, which is actually not an art specifically, but the root of all science. So could you tell us, now that COVID's lifted and we can do stuff in person, what is the Makeda Academy up to and what are your plans for the future?
Well, it's interesting. COVID has had a big influence on the evolution of our academy, because we just really got started at the end of 2019. We were beginning to kind of figure out where we were at and where we fit within this overall landscape. And it was very much in our vision to do education, as the term academy implies, to do retreats, to do seminars, to do all sorts of conferences and events. And the presumption would be that these would be in-person events at different venues, a lot in South America, but also Europe and Canada. And COVID came along and pretty much shut that down for 3 years. And we had to pivot. We went online and tried to develop an online presence, which we did over the last 2 years. We did various events online, podcasts and virtual symposia and this sort of thing. And people can look at the McKenna Academy. If you just go to McKenna.academy, look at that and look at the tab that says calendar, and you can see what we've done, you know, over that period. So the option to do physical conferences didn't really come up until last year. And COVID began to ease off a little bit. I wouldn't say it's over with, but it's eased off. Nobody seems concerned. So we did this seminar or this symposium in the UK last May called ESPD 55. That was our first in-person seminar since 2019. And ESPD 55 stands for Ethnopharmacologic Search for Psychoactive Drugs, and it's the 55th anniversary of the first conference by that name in 1967 that was sponsored by the National Institute of Mental Health in San Francisco, and they published a symposium volume from that. It was a private conference, not open to the public, but subsidized by the taxpayers. And the only thing the taxpayers ever got from this was the symposium volume that they published by that name, which for years you could order from the U.S. government printing office. That volume came into my hands at the age of 18, which was very timely because I was all over it. It made me understand that not only was there an indigenous element to these things, but there was actually science behind this. There were, you know, chemistry, pharmacology, botany, anthropology, all of those things were sort of succinctly represented in this book. And I was inspired by it. It was really what made me decide to pursue ethnopharmacology as a career. It was the first I'd ever heard that ethnopharmacology existed and that it could be a career. Not that there were many of 1967, but they, you know, the giants of the field were there. Andrew Weil, Alex Shulgin, and of course, R.E. Schultes was the main catalyst for that. And so they published this volume. And they were supposed to have symposia, follow-up symposia, every 10 years or so. Well, the war on drugs intervened, and it never happened. So in 2017, I decided to, okay, if the government's not going to do it, somebody needs to do it. So we organized ESPD 50 in 2017, and then the five-year follow-up to that, ESPD 55, last year. And people can look at espd55.com, and all the content is open, or you may have to put in your email and a password, but the content's available. And there's a lot of good stuff up on those sites. And also the ESPD 50 is accessible from that same site. And so it was, you know, these symposia are designed to be kind of a, you know, an overview of the state of the art. And, you know, ethnopharmacology is not a marginalized or not a relic discipline. It's actually a very active discipline. There are unknown plants, unknown fungi that need to be investigated, and new understandings about the ones that we already know about. So this website, ESPD55, is chock full of all that, some great presentations, and I urge people to look at that if you're fanatic about this subject. It's a well of information.
Yeah, and I would add too that I got access to it and I was looking through it, and there's some amazing cutting edge talks there. People might recognize the name Paul Stamets, Wade Davis, David Nutt, Mark Plotkin, yep. Dennis McKenna. Hopefully they know that name if they're watching this.
we have some great presenters, very high profile presenters, and good material. You know, I mean, some of the best material. Well, you know, the people that we all know in this sphere, you just reel them off: Stamets, Wade Davis. You know, who else? Well, you know, these folks are well known, but some of the lesser known people, and that's kind of the idea of the symposium, is to give these people an opportunity to present their work. Some of them are doing amazingly interesting work. You know, this one fellow investigating psychoactive tryptamines from marine sponges, for example. You know, another person, Shaheen Etbenen, Iranian ethnopharmacologist and neuroscientist, presented on Zoroastrian psychedelics. You know, and it turns out they're probably part of the Zoroastrian tradition. You don't hear about those every day, you know. So there's good stuff, and hopefully, you know, ESPD will be an ongoing thing that the Academy can do. People have said, well, when is ESPD 60 going to be? Well, not for a while, but we just did ESPD 55. But I hope we're still around, and when the time comes, that would be what? 2027 would be, yeah. So anyway, this is very much within the mission of the Academy, you know, to present educational material. That said, our focus has in some ways shifted, or maybe broadened is a better way to put it. We're not so much exclusively focused on psychedelics anymore. Those are still important. We're still very interested, but we've sort of broadened our perspective. What we're preoccupied with right now is this project in Peru to digitize this herbarium in Iquitos. I have worked with the university in Iquitos effectively for 50 years. You know, I first went there as a graduate student. I met the person who was also a student at the time, who took me out to the field under the direction of the director of the herbarium at the time. Well, now this fellow, Juan Ruiz is his name, he is the curator. So he's a little younger than me, but not that much. And we've stayed in touch, collaborated, and done projects really over the last 50 years off and on. And now we want to go to the next step. We want to digitize the collections in the herbarium. We want to record Juan's knowledge, which is incredibly deep. And none of it is written down. You know, he's not a person that writes stuff down. So we need to get material onto video, just do in-depth interviews with him about to try to document his knowledge. You know, and in conjunction with that, we also want to do a series of documentaries about this current sort of state of the art of Amazonian traditional medicine, which is very much alive. People will still rely on what's in the forest. You know, to them, the forest is the pharmacy. Many of these people who live in and around Iquitos, you know, they couldn't go to a pharmacy if they wanted to because they can't afford it. They go to their They go to the marketplace. They go to their local herbalist. And these people have practical knowledge of many, many plants that can be used to treat all kinds of things. So that knowledge is worth preserving. And that's what we hope to do. We hope to do 6 to 8 documentaries about Amazonian traditional knowledge, which will include a lot of these interviews with Juan Ruiz. We completed the first one just before last year and showed it at the ESPD 55 conference. So we sort of have branded this sort of thing as biognosis. Let me see. Oh, I'm not looking at Zoom, so I don't know where the text box is. Anyway, maybe this is the text box. No, not the text box. Okay. Anyway, you can
bio-gnosis.
Put it in the text box. Put biognosis in the text box.
Yeah.
Or go I can to put the it website on screen. It will come up. Yeah. So that's what our focus is right now, is kind of trying to bring this underfunded, neglected, forgotten, obscure herbarium, which happens to be in the middle of the most biodiverse area on the planet, make that a world-class resource for science and for anyone, really, with an interest in plant medicines, including the indigenous people. We want to involve the local people and make it possible for them to share their knowledge on this website, you know, to the degree that they wish to disclose what they know. So that's going to be a 3 to 5 year project. We think we need to raise about $10 million to do this properly. So far, we're a long way from that, but we are getting interest. And so we just persist, you know. And I'll be presenting on this at the MAPS conference in Denver, which I'm looking forward to very much.
Psychedelic Science 2023.
It's going to be a wild scene. I mean, it'll be a zoo, but it'll be a nice zoo. 10,000 of our closest friends, you know.
A big party. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'll be there as well. And on the topic of biognosis, there's a quote from the first episode of the documentary series that I want to read that you read in there. You said, and it speaks to the urgency of what it really means about what's going on. You say, this knowledge is being rapidly lost. The thing is, we're losing it without even knowing what we are losing. We're right in the middle of it. It is happening right now. The library is already on fire. The Amazon is burning. The elders are dying. And we need to learn to make the right decisions. So my question would be, for viewers at home, if in such a big, ambitious project, what can they do to help support biognosis and the McKenna Academy?
Well, if they have means, they can fund us. They can give us funds. We are a nonprofit 501c3 registered with the IRS. So any financial contributions, people can get tax deductions for that. But then the other aspect of it is, you know, let people know about this project and also provide opportunities to talk about it, you know, like you're doing right now. You know, I think the more people that know about it, the better chance we'll have to get funding. We're happy to accept funding at any level, you know, because, you know, support from many people can accumulate. We're also looking for those rare investors who sort of, well, I don't call them investors because what they're investing in is knowledge. They're not going to get a profit out of it, but they're investing on the preservation of knowledge. And we're looking for those rare investors or donors who have considerable means and can think about, you know, for example, endowing this project. You know, we need seed money to get started. We have started it. We need more. We figure if we could get a couple of million or 2 or 3 million in seed money, that would enable us to move this vision forward, all of the projects forward. And it would attract more attention. It would give us more resources to bring more donors into the sphere. It would attract attention and it would attract support. And again, MAPS is an example of this. You guys are very good at raising funds. Most people, if I said we need to raise $10 million, they would look a little shocked. MAPS has been down this road and beyond, you know. I mean, what you're trying to raise, what, $50 million? Or more than that now to develop MDMA?
Well, MAPS and, US, they'll be doing our sister organization. They have their own fundraising projects going on. MAPS Canada, we have our own studies going on in Canada around the SAP and sort of the Canadian ecosystem. But yeah, they're heavyweights, to put it lightly.
They are. And, you know, more power to them. I mean, they set an example on what can be done. It's a little different with our project because we're not, in some ways, trying to develop psychedelic drugs and change, you know, change medicine and completely revolutionize mental health care, you know, in the developed world. That's an ambitious program and that's very sexy, you know. The herbarium in Iquitos, maybe not so sexy, but still an important element. The idea is to create this resource online and make it an interactive kind of enterprise where many people can contribute to it, both in terms of not only financial support, but expertise and, whatever they can bring to the table. I mean, we can, you know, we welcome volunteers and people that want to donate their time, but we also, you know, we have many volunteers. What we don't have is enough bandwidth to put all those people to work, you know. We'd like to be able to do that. So it's a perpetual situation with small nonprofits, you know. You never reach a point where you say, okay, we've raised enough money. You know, it just doesn't happen that way. You know, you're never going to reach a point where you say, okay, now we can catch our breath and take all this money we've raised and go ahead and do it. It has to be an ongoing process. But we're hoping that we can raise enough funds in the next couple of years to really push these projects forward. And you know, because we're educational, a lot of what we have to do is communicate. So we want to also use those resources to make people aware of what we're trying to do. And I think that will get people excited. It's actually a very sexy project, but it's not, it doesn't have the same kind of, cachet that psychedelic research has. You know, yeah. Not that it's not relevant to psychedelic research. I mean, there are undiscovered psychedelics in the Amazon to this day that nobody knows much about, and those should be investigated, you know. So
absolutely.
That's kind of the thrust of what we're doing with the Academy right now.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, being sexy is one thing, but the documentary definitely shows how beautiful the project is. And if people want to watch the Bionosis, I guess episode one premiere of the documentary series, they can see that on the ESPD 55 online portal.
Yes, they can. And when we get off this, I'll send you a link to the documentary alone so that people can watch it. At ESPD 55, they have to watch the whole presentation. But if people just want to watch the documentary, then they go to this other link, and I'll send you links to that, and also to the PowerPoint that I presented at ESPD 55.
Cool.
So
awesome.
People can
and
look
so
at
link
that
in the description right now. Can go down right
Excuse
now
me?
And check out the link. People can just check out the link right now.
Oh, yeah, okay.
When they're watching it later after this is edited.
Right.
Yeah. This isn't live. But so an interesting aspect of the Bionosis project that I saw was the visionary rainforest element. And what came to mind was the, I don't know if you've heard of it, but the Imagine Van Gogh, the immersive exhibition that's been touring around the world with like projectors on the walls and the floor and everything like that. Is that, what's your vision for the visionary rainforest?
Well, it's similar to that. Yes. We want to create an immersive virtual environment, you know, that utilizes the cutting edge technology in virtual reality and also artificial intelligence. And, you know, these fields are advancing so rapidly, exponentially, it's hard to even imagine, you know, what it might look like. But in my kind of maybe dumbed down view of it, it's not really dumbed down, but the specimens in the herbarium that are online, it will be in a database, right? And there'll be each specimen will be linked to other sources of information, like maybe phytochemical or ethnobotanical data or genomic data, whatever. There's all kinds of data out there. Each specimen in the herbarium, in this digitized collection, becomes a node of information. You know, like I say in the documentary, every specimen tells a story. And you can click on that node and open up that collection, and that tells you things about it. Usually at least who collected it, what it is, sometimes what it's for. But you can link those nodes to other existing databases. So the idea is that as I visualize the virtual environment, you effectively look at, it's laid out as a geographic grid with markers for these collections based on where they were collected. Most of the collections in the Iquitos Herbarium are around that area, you know, in the Loreto province. So you go in, you fly into this virtual environment, and there are all these nodes, markers you can click, and then you can open up each one and get all this information. But you have the subjective experience of effectively being able to fly through this environment. And the people with the AI expertise and the virtual, you know, the graphics expertise and all that will be able to make it very interactive and very beautiful. And the idea is that to bring this alive, not everyone can go to the Amazon, you know, and not everyone should go to the Amazon. I mean, that's the problem. Too many people want to go. In a way, we can bring the Amazon to the people, you know, give them this in virtual environment where they can explore, you know, without impacting it. They can have this experience and make it as real as possible. And you know, given the way the technology is evolving so quickly, I think we can make it a very real, engaging, interactive, immersive kind of experience. And it will be available online. Obviously, it's got to be online. That's where it will be. But we also hope to form alliances with like science museums, botanical gardens, and things like that, where this technology could be integrated into their programs, and we could organize symposia and conferences around that, in which this would sort of be at the kernel of it. I mean, the possibilities are almost limitless once we have the tool. And but the tool to create this is going to take you know, time and money and a lot of volunteer help. And, you know, we effectively, a lot of this work will be done with student volunteers at the University of Iquitos. So, you know, graduate students and undergraduates, and they'll be very, you know, they will benefit from getting effectively work study support for doing this work. And but, you know, so it's an ongoing vision, and it is getting more elaborate all the time. You know, what we need to do now is get the nuts and bolts together, the financial resources to create it. Once we have that, there's any number of directions it can go. And I think, you know, once people see this begin to take shape, then they will be much more inclined to, to support it. I can only do so much by raving about it. We've got to create an environment where you can actually experience at least some of it and see what it would look like. That's where our funds are going to go if we are able to successfully raise funds. That's first place. That and documenting this gentleman's knowledge, Wanderee's, documenting his knowledge and digitizing what specimens we can, and just build the whole thing. But it will take a while.
Yeah, and if anyone's listening who happens to have $10 million, I know back in the day, George Harrison, member of the Beatles, for all the Zoomers listening to this, he personally funded the Monty Python movie, The Life of Brian, I believe. And he said he just really wanted to watch it, was his reason. So if anyone really wants to be immersed in the Amazon, then they can get the most expensive ticket to an immersive experience in the Amazon, $10 million or less.
That's right. Well, $10 million, you know, you might be able to, pay Jeff Bezos to give you a 15-minute suborbital space flight, or you could give it to the McKenna Academy and, you know, we'll create the virtual rainforest. And if you're the major donor, you can live there. As far as we're concerned, you can be immersed in it all the time. I think we could provide a richer, maybe more memorable experience in some ways. Not that I wouldn't like to do a suborbital flight myself, but it's not likely I'll be able to afford. I wouldn't spend the money on it anyway. I'd spend it for this.
Yeah.
This may make a difference. The idea is, in part, let people know about the biodiversity that's there and what is being lost, and potentially, you know, how to slow this down a little bit if you can add value to these collections, and just presenting the information associated with these plants. Each scrap of information adds value to the plant, you know, because it shows it does not live in isolation. It's connected to the life of the people, its role in the ecosystem, all of those things.
Yeah. Awesome. And as we get closer to the end, we actually have a gift for you, Dennis. Speaking of AI, VR, and tools like that, I'm going to send you an image to your email right now. And so if you want to, you can go open that up live right now.
Okay.
It's an AI art that I've generated from an image that of yours online. And I call it Love of the Leaf with Dennis McKenna. And feel free to use that image as you wish with your social media team or personal or whatever. And let me know when.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. That is great. Thank you.
Yeah. It was made with Midjourney.
Was this made with AI? Of course it was, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I have that big a nose? My God. Anyway, I'll take it. I won't be the art critic. This is great, Luke. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Yeah,
I will use that if I can. In some, I might have to make that my. I'll find a use for it if that's okay.
Totally, do whatever you want with it.
Thanks. Appreciate awesome. It.
And maybe as we get closer to the end, I have one question I would really like to ask you. So I had the privilege and opportunity to sit down with the Padrino Paolo Roberto, the sort of head of the Santo Daime, a few times. And one thing that really struck me about him was how sharp, how lucid, how clear-headed he was, how present he could be in actually listening. And I think now he was 74, so he's probably like 75 now. Very advanced age and very sharp for someone at that age. And there's ayahuasqueros have a reputation of having good cognitive function late into their life. I'm curious if you, as a longtime journeyer with the medicine ayahuasca and also psilocybin, do you feel like it's helped you personally in your aging with cognitive function, et cetera? And if you have any thoughts on what the mechanism might be for that, I'd love to hear.
Well, I do feel like I feel like it's benefited me. The thing is, if you look at the Santo Daime, I think one of the important things about using ayahuasca or any of these things for kind of maintaining cognitive functions is you need to take it regularly, and they take it about every 2 weeks, and that really helps keep them sharp. In fact, if you're, you know, our study with the UDV back in the 90s, we actually screen people in the study cohort for cognitive functions, verbal ability, memory, and all those things. And they all scored significantly better than control subjects of the same age and demographics who didn't drink ayahuasca. And they're basically the bottom line. There was no indication of any impairment of cognition or, you know, the verbal ability, the usual things you associate with having a sharp mind. I can't say that it's worked that way for me. I think for one thing, I haven't been taking it every 2 weeks for 40 years. Maybe that's the problem. I definitely feel like it does benefit. And this is where one, this may be one place where microdosing could make a difference. Although I'm a kind of a skeptic about microdosing, but other people seem to benefit. I think that as far as mechanism is concerned, I think a lot of the neuroscience that is coming out, particularly around psilocybin, but also with ayahuasca, shows that, you know, these things, they increase synaptic connectivity, they stimulate neurogenesis, they definitely do things that, at least in animal models and also human models, we can tell from neuroimaging, they increase the connectivity of certain parts of the brain. And I think that's the mechanism. You know, the psychedelics, like there's an acute phase where with the experience, you know, and that's a big part of the therapeutic action, but then it doesn't quit there. I think the reason that these therapies are so effective and so persistent, the effect doesn't fade, that's because a lot of things happen after the session, you know, with increases in neural connectivity and neurogenesis, and this is pretty solid now. So that's why they're showing promise even for things like early stage Alzheimer's and other cognitive deficits, because people actually improve on those parameters after psilocybin. I think psilocybin is primarily what they're looking at, but the same would apply to ayahuasca and some of these other things. So that's a whole other area that, you know, that now that that no one would have suspected, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, now that the research has opened up, we have an opportunity to explore these new areas. I mean, psychedelics are about the closest thing that you can come to what you might call a broad spectrum psychotherapeutic drug, you know, because this common mechanism that they have can address a lot of issues, everything from PTSD to depression to addiction to, you know, the other things it's known to be useful for. It's unusual that any drug would have, you know, such wide application, but it's because at the basis of it, there's a common mechanism. And, you know, we can get into that another time. But basically, I think it has to do with restructuring your default mode network, you know, which is kind of the framework through which you view the world, the hallucination that you construct, you know, that is your reality. You know, you can reorganize it so it's a more life affirming, because we, you know, part of the problem with the default mode network is it can be, there's a lot of kludge that can accumulate in it. If you can clear that out, it works better, you know, and that's a persistent effect. So anyway.
Yeah, and if anyone wants to, they can Google the entropic brain theory and how that relates to the default mode network and the benefits of psychedelics if they're interested in that. And yeah, I know there was research for microdosing LSD that found it increased the BDNF, brain-derived nootropic factor, which is relevant for neuroplasticity. So it seems like that might be one of the things that microdosing does benefit, potentially. Mm-hmm. But, you know, yeah, it's a... psychedelics are so weird, aren't they? And how they affect so much. And
well, there's, yeah, they are, they're weird, but they're actually fascinating. I mean, you know, I've been working in this field for ever since I was a teenager, you know, so I wouldn't call it working. I mean, what I was doing earlier was probably should not be described as working, but let us say exploring the potential of these substances, and anyone who has these experiences got to, you know, whether or not they become fanatics about it, they've got to recognize that these are significant substances. So I was excited about it when I discovered them as a teenager. I'm still excited about them. You know, and I'm very glad there's a new generation coming on, several new generations.
We got
continuing this work. You know, I have hope for humanity. I recently contributed to a book that was edited by Stephen Gray Carey called How Psychedelics Can Help Save the World. Interesting book. It's just out. I don't know if psychedelics can help save the world. I don't know if they can save the world. They're not going to hurt. You know, they're one of many tools that we need to try to save the world. So I recommend that book. That's interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. And they can help us not destroy the world and then help us save the world for what needs
number one done. And number two, exactly.
Yeah. Put don't the do the bad thing and then do the good out thing.
How to clean up the mess that we've made. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think exactly. It's too late.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Great. Well, I guess we can cap it there. Thank you so much for hopping on, and I will see you at Psychedelic Science.